G'day and welcome to the next episode of Wealth of Experience. I'm Graham Hand, the Managing Editor of the First Links Newsletter and Editorial Director at Morningstar.
And I'm Peter Warnes, Head of Equities Research at Morningstar and the Editor of Your Money Weekly.
And as usual, we'll start with a quick disclaimer that any advice in this podcast is general in nature and does not consider your personal financial circumstances or needs. Today, Peter and I will be looking at some of his best stock ideas with a particular emphasis on infrastructure stocks. Peter will be talking about Sydney Airport, APA and Horizon. We'll discuss a subject that we've been giving a lot of coverage in First Links on how much you can spend in your retirement. And also, increasingly, we're seeing a disconnect between what analysts calculate the value of a company and what is actually being paid for some assets. We also have a guest today. Andrew Lockhart is the managing partner of Metrics Credit, who will talk about investing in corporate debt funds. So, Peter, here we are again in lockdown. This one feels a little bit different. We're in Sydney, and I feel a little bit more of there's a shock to confidence because, you know, there's no JobKeeper. We're uncertain what essential work really means. I think in Sydney we thought we were through this, and I really wonder whether the growth outlook for the economy, particularly now Victoria's also closed down, is a little bit less confidence than there would have been a few months ago.
Yes, Graham. I mean, no doubt that the confidence is going to be a little bit dented, and the growth expectations are going to be shaved. But again, these things will pass. All I've noticed out there while I've been going walking around on my daily exercises, the gentlemen out there, their hair is getting closer to their shoulders. And those others that whose partners or wives have taken to the to hairdressing, they've made a damn awful job of what they've done. So, things will get better. We've got to stay positive. The expectations of the third quarter GDP could get shaved by up to half to three quarters of a percent, but no one's going to worry about that in 2 years' time.
Yeah, we'll talk about things getting better. Let's get your thoughts on what's happening with Sydney Airport to start with. It sort of shows how the market can see through some of these short-term problems. So, because here you have an airport that is almost empty, and there's this debate about how quickly traffic will recover. There's a sort of a threat of a new airport in 2026. And here's an offer on the table, which is 43% above where the share price was trading before the offer came in. And still the board knocks it back. It's an asset which the government sold many years ago for $6 billion. And then the good fellows at Macquarie and subsequent management certainly learned how to make a quid out of an airport with parking fees, and you can't walk through the place now without getting bombarded by retail. So the Australian super funds are having a good look at this asset.
Yeah, well, they are, and clearly they're looking through all the problems that they're out there at the moment. You didn't mention all the toll roads you've got to pay on the way to the airport before Macquarie get their hands on you. But still, in all, we've got to again look forward, look to what's going to happen around Sydney Airport. What's going to happen in 3, 5, 10 years' time with the pandemic? All I can say is I think that a lot more people in the world will want to come to Australia, and Sydney Airport will be the gateway, as it has been for the last 50 years, and the super funds and long-term investors are looking at assets that can match to their long-term liabilities. In other words, the super funds have got liabilities to pay pensions out from the next century or so, and they'll be looking to get assets that match and that the cash flow that those assets can generate to match those commitments. And so there's no doubt that the boffins at the super funds and private equity have made some assumptions on what that cash flow looks like going forward. They certainly wouldn't have used a discount rate on those that cash flow reflecting current bond yields. They would have used a much more conservative bond yields, probably got a 4 in front of it, and still come up with a price of $22 billion or $8.25 per staple security. My feeling is that price is too low. The board has already unanimously rejected the offer, and there will be more to say on what happens and how this thing plays out. Don't forget that 8.25 is still comfortably below where the stock was trading at pre-pandemic. And I would think that to budge the board, you're going to need a 9 in front of it and a high 9, not a low 9. And I think, strangely enough, that even now at current prices around the 780, it's relatively attractive. I'm looking for stocks that have got limited downside, because I do think this market is meaningfully overpriced. Looking for stocks that have got limited downside or are significantly below fair value. And that's providing you an opportunity to what I believe you should be doing is looking to trim some fat out of your portfolios where there have been some very, very strong rises. Don't sell them all and just take the tops off a few of them and reinvest that in undervalued situations. And I think infrastructure is allowing you, is an opportunity that you should look at. And Sydney Airport is certainly one of those situations. Elsewhere, and I was writing the overview this on Monday and Tuesday, and talking about these infrastructure situations on the back of Sydney Airport, and we looked across our infrastructure list, and we saw three stocks there, or I saw three stocks there that looked interesting. Firstly, APA. Secondly, Horizon, and thirdly, Spark Infrastructure. Well, as I was writing, or just after I'd finished my article, out comes a bid for Spark. And we saw, strangely enough, on Wednesday afternoon, all of the energy infrastructure stocks took off, led by Spark, followed by APA and AusNet. And so if you look at APA, again, those three stocks that I mentioned, APA, Horizon, and Spark, they're all been tarred with a ESG brush, because they're all stocks that are related to fossil fuel, if you like, and no one likes those. And I think that's been overplayed, and overplayed dramatically. And I think that provides opportunity for investors to look at these situations. Now, APA, we know what they do. It's the best and the biggest footprint of gas transmission pipelines across the country. They are in renewables. And only 2 years ago, or 3 years ago now, 2018, the Hong Kong Chinese put a bid on the table through CK Infrastructure at $11 a share. It was knocked back by the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, at the time, and that was in national interests. And I applauded that move because it is a national interest asset. Why would you give your transmission pipelines, the ownership of them, to a foreign investor? So the whole thing would change if Australian super funds put a consortium together and made a offer for APA. At $11, the board of APA previously, they had unanimously agreed to roll over, but Josh Frydenberg got in their way. So I think, again, APA gas is going to be around for many, many decades as an energy, an ideal energy source. The transmission pipelines will be their cash generator. They are obviously diversifying into some renewables. The yield at the current price is 5.2%, with some franking, about 50% franked. And so I think, again, even though it's trading at our fair value, I think it's, or just under our fair value at 960, I think if the heat comes out of this market, just watch that situation and it could come back and be much more attractive.
I think the other one you mentioned, Aurizon, is also an interesting case. And we've seen this massive increase in funds that are focusing on ESG principles, Australian Ethical, big increase in funds in the last 12 months. But the sort of harsh reality of the need to generate power around the world is, as you say in your editorial this week, that Australian metallurgical coal will remain a key ingredient in Asian steel mills for several decades. And that in countries like Japan, Indonesia, Vietnam, India, they're still building coal-fired power stations. So, you know, I know people have very strong views on climate change, and certainly a transition to renewables is essential for all of our futures. But the fact is that a lot of less developed countries, and even countries like Japan, which are not less developed, have power needs, and coal is going to meet those needs for a long time yet. And Aurizon, as a rail network, is a critical piece of the supply chain.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that is the critical infrastructure between mine and port. And there's going to be a hell of a lot of Australian coal go offshore. Aurizon's is most of its coal is coming out of Queensland, and it is metallurgical coal, which is obviously for steel making, and that will be used for many, many decades. You might see some easing up in the exports of thermal coal, albeit as you point out that China, India, Japan, Indonesia, and Vietnam, they're still planning to build over 600 coal-fired power stations, which will be generating energy in 2045 and 50. So that Australian thermal coal, rightly or wrongly, will be exported and has to be moved from mine to port, and Aurizon's rail network is the asset of choice. So that there's a situation that the fair value, we've got a fair value of 470. The stock's trading at 360. Had a little bit of a bounce the other day. It's yielding 7.6% at the current price on our 2022 dividend of 29 cents, 70% franked. You're allowed to at least entertain the possibility that you should add that to your portfolio if you're trimming off some banks or some iron ore miners or what have you that have gone through the roof over the past 12 months. All I'm saying is look for those opportunities to, again, diversify your portfolios, but also, you know, efficiently investing some cash that you might take off the table.
And on infrastructure, the other stock you mentioned, well, Toll Road you mentioned, and that's obviously synonymous with Transurban. And it's another factor of life in our major cities that getting around with the increased time efficiency of toll roads comes with a cost. And Transurban really does have some fantastic assets. If you look at just the Eastern Distributor, when that opened, the toll was $3.50. The toll is now over $8. And I think compared to the early days when it opened, where you had to put your money, you had to put your hand in your wallet and take out a some coins or a note and give it to a person at the toll booth. Now you just drive through. And I don't think people really realize that every time they're doing that, they're paying at least $8. And at the end of the month, there's a debit to your account. And so Transurban has developed this network of toll roads. And I actually personally own Transurban. And I actually, when I drive through, I actually think, okay, yes, there's my dividend. I don't think of it as a payment. I think of it as a revenue stream. But they have been able to lock down a great network of tolls. But look, let's move on from the infrastructure for a moment, Peter, and look at some of your other stock ideas. TPG Telecom is on your radar as well.
Well, again, looking for stocks that are undervalued and with an opportunity to push the share price towards our fair value with not a lot of risk. This company was the darling of the telecommunications sector only 3 or 4 years ago, led by a very, very hard-nosed businessman, David Teoh, and he put the pressure on the mobile space, if you like, when he decided he could be the fourth player in that sector of the telecommunications industry. Common sense prevailed, thank goodness, and he and Vodafone got together, and so that there's a cozy, if you like, oligopoly between the three: Telstra, TPG, and Optus. Now, as I said, he was a hard-nosed, cost-cutting individual, and created havoc through the telecommunications industry because they all followed him down. He put pressure on them, and they cut the prices. Well, now David's moved on, and the merger with Vodafone is complete. There was a risk, if you like, or a concern that the two management strategies between of TPG and Vodafone would clash, but now that David's now basically out of the stock, he's still a shareholder, but he's not involved in the day-to-day management, and his offsider has also now moved on. That now the Vodafone people are in control, the industry dynamics are improving, TPG's initial growth story was based on broadband, and of course NBN cruel that, and so their earnings have been under pressure the last couple of years. But now the broadband, ADSL broadband, they've only got now about $60 million they can lose to NBN, and that's only about 5% of their earnings. So the all clear is almost there for TPG. The culture clash has been resolved and resolved reasonably quickly. The balance sheet, you don't have to worry about it. It is in very good shape. Valuation-wise, it's about 7.5x EBITDA, and the global average is about 8.5. And if we look at pandemic impact, clearly, things like global roaming revenues have been absolutely slaughtered. But again, looking forward, when the pandemic is a little bit of history and the vaccination rates reach the 80% plus, we will return to normality. And so up goes global roaming revenues. We have got some common sense now in mobile pricing. And so TPG looks now to be looking for tailwinds rather than headwinds. And so again, With a fair value of $7.40, trading at $6.15, a skinny dividend, and they'll be cautious about that until we get clear of the pandemic and the global roaming revenues void. 14 cents as our estimate for next year, 100% frank, but the yield's skinny at 2.3. But again, it's something that's got very limited downside, even when a market pulls back, and upsides, which is attractive.
And there's one thing for sure is that in our futures, we're certainly going to be using mobiles and internet more. That's one trend that's not going to stop.
Exactly right. You know, and talking infrastructure, other vehicles that people could look at as the is an ETF with the code is IFRA, obviously infrastructure IFRA. The stock's around about $21, and a fund that we had in Your Money Weekly this week that our manager research people have given a very high rating to is Lazard Global Listed Infrastructure, which closed its books off to institutional investors, but is still available for retail investors. Now, Graham, in First Link, what have you been seeing across your desk? How much can we spend in retirement? That's a question I'd love to love you to answer, because at some stage, I guess I will retire.
I don't think you'll ever stop working, Peter. But look, we have had a really good discussion in First Links in the last couple of weeks on spending in retirement. We started with an article from Don Ezra. Now, anyone who's been in superannuation for the last few decades would know Don. He was the co-chairman of global consulting at Russell Investments, and Russell provides advice to the large super funds. But now Don is well retired, and he explained in this article how he sat down and decided how much he and his wife could afford to spend in what's called the decumulation stage or during retirement. So he broke down the problem into three stages. The first one, he said, how long can we live for? And, you know, so he took his current age. He knew his wife had probably lived longer than he does. So he looked at the sort of the longevity tables, and, you know, there's a good chance that most of us will live around until the age of, say, 90. And then he said, how should I allocate between my assets? So he made a simple assumption about equities, in this case, global equities versus more defensive instruments. And then did his calculations and to decide how much can I take from my pool of savings each year to make sure that it doesn't run out by the time I'm likely to die. And, you know, I think a lot of people who are listening to this podcast would expect to be financially independent, do not rely on the age pension. So I won't go into his full methodology, but he concluded, based on these assumptions, and everyone's assumptions would be different, he also likes to hold a sort of cash reserve. In his case, he wants to have a few years up his sleeve, where if the market falls, he's not required to sell. His conclusion was that for each 100,000 in his pension pot, he could have a sustainable withdrawal of around $5,000. And, you know, you can think, well, look, that's only 5%. That doesn't seem like such a stretch. But there's a lot of literature that's been saying recently that with interest rates falling, you know, bond rates in many parts of the world, well, even negative, but let's say between 1% and 2%, getting even 5% as an income requires you to take some risk in the equity market or another asset class. So if you're going to be very conservative, then you draw 5% of your pension pot, then obviously you're going to also be drawing down some of your capital. And so that's a sort of a guideline number. I'm pretty comfortable with 5%. I think if you took 5% out, even if you lived to be 100, with a reasonable allocation to growth assets, you should be fine and not run out of money. Would you be happy with 5%, Peter?
Well, it depends on my selection of red wine.
Yeah, I've heard there's some expensive taste there.
Well, you only live once. Now, this is an interesting topic here, the disconnect between fundamental or intrinsic value and the price of some assets. That disconnect, to me, right now, is a major disconnect.
Yeah, this is a fascinating subject because, you know, you do have some things in the market that I think we've never seen before. And I know that markets, you know, go back hundreds of years. You'll always find excesses and manias. But there are some things that are happening at the moment we've simply never seen before. If you actually look at what someone has to do to become what's called a CFA in our industry, the Chartered Financial Analyst, that is a really tough gig. You know, you've got to spend years of studying. They say 300 hours for each level of the exam. And analysts are taught, as Peter talks about, things like PEs, free cash flow, a whole range of measurements, book value, on how to come up with what you might say is the value of a company, the intrinsic value, and you compare that with the current share price, and it gives you an indication of whether it represents good value. But what we have out there at the moment is we have a market which is very heavily influenced by noise, by social media, by what's called meme stocks, where someone can put a story in the market that a certain stock is the focus of the week. The most powerful in the market is Elon Musk, who, let's face it, is an incredibly successful guy. Only a few months ago, he was the richest person in the world, since been overtaken by Jeff Bezos from Amazon. But simply due to this sort of social media, a sort of online chat, a company can see dramatic increases in prices with no change in its fundamentals. And of course, the other asset in this sort of category of how do you value it is the cryptocurrency. And a lot of Australians have gone into Bitcoin, but this has become such a massive subject that there are now something around maybe, so some people say 6,000 cryptocurrencies, other people say 10,000. And while there's probably a role for digital currencies in the future, the vast majority, 99% of these cryptocurrencies that people are trading and buying and selling, they're just going to expire worthless. And so there's a lot of things out there. There are companies that not only don't make a profit, but are unlikely to ever make a profit, which are valued in the billions, not even in the millions. And you have this thing we've talked about, FOMO, fear of missing out. So it's a time for people to talk about some of the fundamentals Peter has been discussing. But I would say I've been in the market for maybe 40 years, Peter, a few years longer. I don't think I've ever seen these extremes of this crazy stuff that's happening out there. What do you think? What do you think about what some of this stuff, Peter?
No, well, I mean, being old school and reasonably conservative, I think some of these things are just, you know, have got, you know, the crazies. But, you know, my father probably would have said that, you know, that might be the case with, you know, beer in a bloody can. I mean, I just don't know. The changes that have occurred through, again, technology. I mean, Bitcoin wouldn't be there without technology, if you like. And I don't know, you know, you're not going to see a guy come in with a mask on. We're going to see a lot of masks at the moment, but and say, well, give me your Bitcoins. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't. He wants your cash. I mean, I've never seen a robbery take place, you know, on the news and what have you, where all they want to seem to be is cigarettes and cash. And the things that are happening out there and the scams, I'm not saying these things are scams, but the attention span of a lot of people is very, very short, and they'll just jump on the next train, not even knowing where it's going. Just hopefully they'll be get off and get off safely. Well, in the investing world, that doesn't really happen all the time, and you can have a train wreck. And in a lot of these, you know, kind of ethereal type investments and products, there will be a lot of accidents and a lot of damage, in my opinion.
Yeah, look, I think the difficulty is that while a lot of these new tech ideas, they seem sort of extreme, and you know, how can this possibly work? And then, of course, you get the Amazons of the world, and Amazon made no profits for 20 years. It was driven by someone who had a sort of a different paradigm about growth and customer service. And, you know, if you look back over those 20 years, a lot of very experienced investors would say, you know, this is sort of crazy. The business nearly went into insolvency around the year 2000, around the dot-com time. And for a long time, no one believed the Amazon story. And now you look at Amazon, and it, you know, dominates US retailing and is moving into other countries. So every so often you get a great success story like that, but they get all the headlines, and for every one of them, there's 99 failures.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Amazon story is a fantastic story, but we've been talking about a disconnect between fundamental intrinsic value and the prices. What the analysts missed in Amazon, and missed in a lot of these companies, is they didn't take into account, they were looking at the bottom line in the P&L account, which was obviously red, but they didn't take into account the impact of the marketing and promotional expenses that were being written off year after year after year, building the name, building the position, building the first mover advantage in those particular sectors and segments of the market that they wanted to operate in. And Afterpay and BNPL companies, they're similar. Have a look at what Afterpay have expensed over the last 3 or 4 years. It's exponential growth in marketing and promoting the name, to have it in front of everyone, in front of mind. That will show you that there's no, it's negative cash flow. And how do you then value something that's got a negative cash flow if you're using a discounted cash flow model? Well, the answer is the bottom right-hand corner won't work for you.
Yeah.
But you've got to look at that. And then ultimately, when those companies get to a position of almost, I need you, that's when, you know, the marketing starts rolling off, but the revenues just explode. And so that's the difference and analysts have to recognize that that's the situation.
Yeah, and look, that's exactly right. And I think this is another aspect that has fundamentally changed, that you say, well, if there's negative cash flow, how do you pay your bills? And the answer is you raise capital.
Correct.
And what we've never seen on the scale that we have at the moment, and I was reading this in the Economist, that just for the June quarter that's just passed, the capital raised in startup fintechs alone was about $45 billion.
Yep.
There's a lot of money looking for a home. And, you know, these are smart people with good ideas. That the other thing this number tells me is that business disruption is is a permanent fact of life, because there's an incredible number of great tech ideas which are going to come our way simply because money is being thrown at smart people. And as Peter says, if they've got a growing market and a great idea, they can make losses for many years because their shareholders will fund them.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the decade past has been the decade of the disruptor. There's no doubt about that, and it's probably only going to get worse or better, whichever way you want to look at it. But again, technology and is going to be the tool to open a lot of doors. And we'll look back in 10 years' time and say, how the hell did that happen? You know.
Yeah. So, Peter, I'll just finish up the part of the podcast that's having my chat with you just by mentioning something I've noticed in the last week or two, and that's as my dividend statements come in for the 30th of June, as the tax statements in particular come in, I'm seeing a lot of realized capital gains, which are being passed to me as a tax liability. You know, some funds where I saw the balance rising over the last 6 months because the market's doing very well, and I thought, oh yeah, this is very good. Well, that capital is now being converted into a distribution to me. I think a lot of our listeners are going to be surprised, whether it's an ETF or an unlisted managed fund, because the market has been so strong. We've had people rotating out of winners because they've got expensive, and that means they're realizing capital gains, which legally a trust has to distribute. There's going to be more people with taxable income than they probably expected they were going to get.
Yep, and the and Josh Frydenberg will be very, very happy, given that he's looking at a mountain of debt that he will never be able to jump over in his lifetime and perhaps his children's lifetime.
Yeah, so thanks, Peter. I really enjoyed your stock ideas.
No, that's very good, Graham. Another good chat. And my quirky idea or unusual idea at the end is the unemployment rate at 4.9%. That to me is very, very quirky and unusual. The lowest since 2011. And when that was when that occurred, the bond 10-year bond yield was 5.2% against 1.25% today. That will change.
Okay, and so for the rest of the podcast, I can let you go, Peter. I've got an interview coming up with Andrew Lockhart, the managing partner of Metrics Credit, where we talk about private debt. But look, it's great, been great to have a chat. Thanks for listening to the latest episode of Wealth of Experience. Stay resilient in these difficult times and enjoy your investing.
Yep, bye for now.
Finally, I'd like to welcome a guest to Wealth of Experience. Andrew Lockhart is the managing partner of Metrics Credit Partners. An edited transcript of the full interview will be on the First Links website this week. But welcome, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining the podcast. Andrew, for our listeners who don't know, do you want to give us a short introduction to Metrics?
Yeah, Metrics Credit Partners is a business we set up and launched our first fund in June of 2013. We started with three partners, and we've been successful now to grow the business to running around about $9 billion in assets under management. We have close on 80 employees across the business with operations in Sydney, Melbourne, and in Auckland in New Zealand. Our business is very much around directly originating lending opportunities with companies and providing corporate financing to those companies to support their activities. And off the back of that, we hope to deliver good returns and an acceptable investment product for our investment clients as well.
Yeah, that's been really impressive. We featured in First Links a lot about this ETF versus debate. And I can see why, with an asset class such as yours, that the closed-end structure helps a lot, because even if you wanted to, it's not as easy to liquidate your assets as if you were, you know, holding, say, an ASX 200 fund.
That's exactly right. Our asset class are private loans, so they can't be bought and sold over an exchange. So in an ETF product, you'll have a market maker that has the ability to buy and sell the assets of the fund to create liquidity for investors. In our asset class, the other lenders that are sitting alongside us providing funding to companies are often banks. And there's not a market maker that buys and sells loans to different companies to create liquidity in short periods of time for investors. So the closed-end nature of the vehicle is important because the capital's there. It allows us to lend, and investors have got liquidity through buying and selling their units on the stock exchange, which is, I think, a really attractive feature, because effectively what the investor is able to achieve is to hopefully generate a premium return. So if you're lending for, say, 3 or 5 years, the margin and the fees that you charge to the company will be higher than if you were obligated to have a short-dated exposure to that company. And so, you know, the opportunity for an investor is they're getting a premium or a yield pickup, but they're able to have the flexibility of buying and selling those units at short notice. So best example would be if you lock your money up in, say, a term deposit, you're putting your money into deposit for a number of years, and the return you get reflect the term nature of your investment. With our funds, investors are getting the ability to have a term return from tying up the money in a loan for 3 or 5 years, but getting the ability to get daily access to their capital by trading on the stock exchange on a daily basis if they so wish.
And a lot of the credit you provide is, you know, corporate loans, private credit is to unrated borrowers. And you know, you've done hundreds of transactions. What's been your default and loss experience over the years?
Graham, myself and my partners have been doing this for between sort of 30 to 40 years. The last 8 and a bit years of our track record has been lost since we established Metrix Credit Partners. Over that eight odd years that we've operated Metrix, we've completed lending of close on $15 billion, probably in excess of, you know, 450 individual loan transactions. And our experience is we've never delivered a loss to our investors. We've had 4 companies where we've had to have some form of restructuring or credit management associated with those loans. But in each case, we've been able to manage our investors' exposure and manage our exit from those loans without loss to our investors. So out of those occasions, so, you know, I think there was probably 2 of those 4 borrowers that actually had a default. But we worked through that process to ensure that our investor capital wasn't at risk of loss. So when you lend money, the capital or the part of the capital structure that should wear the risk of loss is equity. And so, you know, shareholders in those companies and those projects obviously suffered a loss, but we as a lender did not. And that's an important feature of where you sit in the capital structure, together with, I guess, the benefits of corporate insolvency laws that are protective of the interests of a secured creditor. And so from our perspective, having a deep understanding of corporate insolvency laws, a deep understanding of the companies we lend to, we are always focused on what are the ways in which we can exit our exposure to ensure we can get our investors' money back if we ever need to. And fortunately, over that period of time, I think we've had a very strong history of track record performance for investors.
So I guess the test is when you have a severe stress event. How did the portfolio go in the sort of the depths of COVID-19, say, you know, March 2020? What was that experience like?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, due credit to the government and the regulators for the support that they provided to the market. You know, had you asked me in sort of February and early March of what I thought the outcome might be, I thought, you know, we might have been facing into a situation of rising unemployment, declining asset prices and a series of defaults. But I guess the combination of the way in which management responded, so management responded with appropriate cuts to contain costs. They certainly managed liquidity. So one of the things we were focused in on is the companies that we lent to, did they have sufficient cash on balance sheet? Did they have available committed funding lines that could be drawn on to support their working capital requirements? And then, of course, we saw the support come through from the government in the form of additional support to businesses to help them through what was really a cash flow squeeze. And then obviously the Reserve Bank lowering interest rates and supporting liquidity and enabling liquidity being provided to the banks was all supportive of economic activity. Because obviously from a lender's and a broader economic position, there's no joy in seeing, companies going into default and struggling. So I think the response of the government was important because it facilitated the retention of employment and opportunities for those companies to weather what was a difficult storm. But equally, what we saw through that period of time were a number of companies that went back and raised equity capital. Right. Now, as a lender, a company raising equity capital is very good because whilst it destroys value for existing shareholders in the form of dilutive equity raisings, fresh equity capital shores up the balance sheet, reduces the risk and gives the company liquidity. So we saw a number of companies do that over that period of March through to the end of May, substantial amounts of equity capital being raised. So I guess our experience is not too dissimilar to what we've seen in other cycles. As a lender, if credit quality or market conditions deteriorate, a lender would usually encourage a company to sell assets to repay debt, maybe raise equity to repay debt. Failing to do those things, then a lender might have to go down the path of enforcing under their securities. But a lender is conscious of preserving and maintaining going concern value to ensure that they get out whole. And fortunately, through our experience, and over the last 12 months, we've had no defaults. We don't have any borrowers in arrears of interest or principal payments, and we've maintained a very strong discipline across our lending activity. Now, we lend to probably around about 190 individual companies. And so having a portfolio that's performing is important because it's what delivers the returns in terms of income and capital stability, less volatility for our investors.
Yeah, and we certainly saw in the listed space around that time last year, a lot of companies going to the equity markets. And, the more of that that happens for people like you in a different part of the capital structure, the better. But can I just ask, you regularly report to the exchange for your listed vehicles, the net asset value. How do you come up with that number when none of your assets are listed?
Yeah, so our assets, it's really important that when we report to investors the NAV of our funds, that they have confidence in the governance structure that oversees that. So we have an independent RE and a trustee across our various funds who's responsible for the oversight of our activities. Importantly, we also derive prices because these are not traded loans, so they're generally loans that are held to maturity. And so one of the best examples that you can deliver is to investors is to show them that you're regularly being repaid and recycling the capital. And that's what we've done over the last 8 years. But importantly, we're subject to continuous disclosure obligations through the ASX. We're subject to materiality thresholds in our asset class that we believe would be low in terms of what is required to report. But importantly, we also have an independent large international accounting firm that test the market value and test the portfolio on a monthly basis to determine whether or not there's any risk of credit loss or impairment that would be a reduction to the value of the portfolio. So as a lender, what you're looking at is you're looking at the credit quality of the borrower, you're looking at the tenor or the term of the loan, and you're looking at the industry and the nature of the loan product that you've made. So there are differences between the way in which a lender prices loans for corporates to, say, a loan to a property development company.
Thanks, Andrew. It's been great to hear about metrics and how the private debt market works.
Thanks very much, Graham. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today.
Thanks again for listening. And don't forget, to provide any comments or questions or suggestions you might have. And we certainly welcome you rating the podcast and following as well. Thanks very much.